Okay, very good.
So today's topic is running a university-based laboratory, guiding students, managing projects. It's very early, of course, for you, because you are still working on your PhD, and it will take a few years before you have people whom you have to manage. The problem with this all is that you probably are not taught how to run a university lab, how to guide people, how to be a boss, essentially. There's nothing in your studies, unless maybe you are in the Department of Management. Then maybe you get some topics that discuss how to run a business, how to run a group. The reason why it's useful for you to hear some of the things now is that you have an opportunity to observe how your advisor is running the group, how this whole thing is developing. You can observe, and when observing, you can learn, and you can reinforce some things. Maybe you will find some things that you don't like doing, and etc. It's kind of interesting thing, because we often learn from our surrounding more than we want to. I bet, maybe it's still too early for you, but when you were teenagers, I'm sure, and you were children yourself living with your parents, there were some things that you didn't like at all. You hated it in your parents. If you are normal, everybody goes through this. And then what happens is at the age of 30-something, when you have your own children, you suddenly realize, after doing something, you say, oh boy, I just did something that I hated as a young person. I just did that to my child. It's a very normal feeling, which testifies that we learn more than we want to learn. There are things we didn't like, maybe for good reasons, and then we learn them. So another thing that you may get out of this is that when you are now observing your advisor, you'll be somewhat critical, and you will not learn the things that you don't want to learn, right? You will notice things that you don't like, and then you can avoid the mistakes that the advisor is doing. So it's essentially running a university-based laboratory, how to be a boss. That's the thing. As you notice here, there's not much left. There are just two meetings left after this one. One is going to be about balancing your life and dealing with stress. That's a useful skill, believe me, because there's going to be more and more work, more and more pressure on you as the career develops. And then the last one is going to be about ethics. Ethics can be taught about in a variety of ways. I hope that the way I chose is going to be interesting for you. We can talk about interesting things here. So now, guiding students. Some introductory remarks, and then some of the things I did. Of course, everybody does things somewhat differently. Every parent is bringing up the children in a slightly different way. Every boss is running the company or the lab in a different way. There are certain specific things in a university environment which I'm going to share with you. Introductory remarks. At some point, I was awarded Outstanding Mentor Award, which is a recognition given to people whose students are very happy, they like him, they voted, and in a certain, it was an organization called Survival Skills and Ethics, and then I was nominated, and then I also won the competition, which was very nice. I was very proud of it. And then they invited me to give an invited lecture on the topic, how I do it. And that's a large part of this presentation is actually from that lecture. That was similar to one day I went with one of my sons. This is my second son. We went to a scouting event. The scouting event was fishing. That was a skill. So we got boats. There was a big lake. And they told us, whoever catches most fish will win the competition. There were some rewards for that. So my son and I caught a few fish. I think this was before going out, so then this is empty still. But we caught, I don't know, 5 or 8 fish, and we were so proud of each other. We thought, wow, we are making a good chance to win. But the winner had I forgot, it was like 120 pounds, like 60 kilograms of fish. Unbelievable. I don't know how they did that. But during the ceremony, the person who was giving them the award told them, and now the catch is that you have to tell how you did it. That was funny. So exactly the same thing they asked me to do, tell how what I do to deserve a student's recognition, happiness. So I'm kind of coming back to the first meeting we had. In science, we are dealing with mentoring. And mentoring is very important because we are teaching skills that are very difficult to learn on your own. And you will learn them from other people, from your mentor, from your advisor. So this is this resembles the apprenticeship, which is like master and apprentice, mistrz i czeladnik. The best place to learn how to be a scientist is to go to the best place you can find, the best university, the best environment. Very often, people who are trained in the best places become very good themselves. Simple idea. They learn from the best people, they learn as much as they can, and they become good themselves. The same problem with families. There are certain families with traditions, and if you are coming from that family, then there is, of course, expectation from you, but we are also learning a lot of good things from your parents. And it doesn't matter what your family is, if it's a noble family or simple workers, it doesn't matter. There's a tradition of bringing up children, and you can learn from the parents. And very often children of good parents, good people, I mean, are also good people themselves. And the tradition of children of people who are kind of honest within the bounds of reason, I would say, like, ironically, children also often go that way. So training people, you have to do it alone, of course, on your own. How to do it? Of course, you have to kind of think about, like, the way you think about the career. What do you want? And for me, it was definitely something very important. I'll tell it in the next couple of slides. One thing I would advise you is to forget about the, in some countries, it's tenure. Tenure is a permanent position. Once you get that position, they cannot fire you. So in US, you get tenure after 6 years of working very hard, showing that you can do it, you get a permanent position. So my advice is always forget about it. Don't worry about it, because it will come. Just do a good work, and you will do it. Take control over your life. So it's you who decides where you are going, how you do things. Ask yourself, what is the most important thing? What is it that you want to achieve in your life, in your career? Think about what your strengths are, and then base everything on your strengths. And of course, experiment. We are scientists, we experiment. We try things out, they don't work, we change it. So a lot of things that you will see are also results of experimenting. Experimenting and checking, does it work or not? How have I approached it? I like, it's an influence of, I guess, the Eastern way of teaching, you know, the Far East, the martial arts, the, you know, a lot of things, even things like yoga. There is always a master and apprentice, and they always stress the foundations. It's important. If you do any martial arts, whether it's judo, karate, or something, they teach you how to stand. So that you are solid on the ground. Very important, the basics. I told you about the kendo. We were walking around with sticks in kendo and just training the basics, the basic steps. So it's always very important in whatever you do, I think, be kind of solid on the ground. One thing that was inspiring in my family is, this is my grandfather, he was telling to his sons, my uncles, who were also going to be soldiers, because he spent, I think, 7 years in Russian cavalry during the First World War, before and during the First World War. He was telling his sons, if you are a soldier, be a good soldier, because if you are, you know, chickening out somewhere, you get killed, and your fellow soldiers will get killed too. So if you are a soldier, be a good soldier. I think it's a very important thing. If you are a teacher, be a good teacher. If you are a scientist, be a good scientist. whatever you do, choose wisely what you want to become, but do it well. Because it's better to be a good plumber than a poor professor. Poor in terms of not very impressive. Professor whose students are cursing, right? You don't want to be a professor like this. You want to be, it's better to be a good plumber, definitely. So, you know, I said it to myself. Again, I kind of wrote it afterwards, but I said to myself, if I want to follow this career, I want to be good at it. I got my second name after my grandfather, an impressive fellow. Lived to be almost 100. Impressive. This is my mother and me. You see the shine in my eyes. I was going to conquer the world at that time already. I guess, you know, the tradition that definitely helped me to choose this career. So a lot of other people, a lot of, especially, you know, young people, and educate them, to give the best of yourself. I really mean it. I'm not just saying it, you know, it's fashionable to say. Actually, it's not very fashionable to say things like that, because that resembles in many places too much Christianity, which is now in disfavor in many cultures now, many cultures that grew up of Christianity. But I do think it's a very important thing. A lot of things are resting on it in our culture. Whatever you do to your fellow people, fellow citizens, neighbors, it's really coming from that. Love everybody. Be good. There are two other things that I found always inspiring. This is a real person, Jaime Escalante. He was a computer scientist with, I guess, a bachelor's or master's degree, not very well educated. But he discovered he wanted to be a teacher. He was already working in the industry, he wanted to be a teacher. And he started teaching in a high school in a very poor neighborhood in Los Angeles. A neighborhood where kids were mostly Hispanic, parents were not well educated, maybe first generation immigrants. The kids were, they didn't know too well what to do with their lives. Girls became pregnant during the high school. Boys, some of them entered gangs. So it wasn't a very nice place. He wanted to teach computer science there. He went there and they tell him, oh, computer science? Sure, but we don't have any computers. It was a poor school in a poor neighborhood. He started teaching calculus, advanced calculus. It's a kind of material above the high school that prepares you for national exams that give you credit when you are in college. Then they give you credit, you don't need to follow the calculus classes. He was tough, at the same time caring for the kids. Somehow he motivated over 20 kids in his class to prepare for that exam. It was tough. They made a very nice movie based on him. A lot of things that I know are based on the movie. So I haven't read his memoirs, but in the movie he was played by one of the American actors. His last name is Olmes, also Hispanic. I forgot his first name. In any case, what happened is after a year, his kids take the exam. They took the exam and most of them passed it. Or all of them passed it, I think, in that whole group. Amazing. And the problem was that they noticed that the kids were making the same mistakes. So they suspected them of cheating. There were a couple of guys who came from that organization that does the exam, and they were trying to find out how they were cheating, how they got the exams so well. But they couldn't find it out, so they made them redo the exam again. They did the exam very well, even better than the original exam. And he was quite strong at the time. He said, well, I want the original exam to be reinstated because that was insulting to suspect my kids of cheating. And then every year after, more and more kids were passing that exam. Amazing. And there is a quote from him that says, if we expect kids to be winners and expect them to well, they will rise to the occasion. If you expect them to be losers, they will be losers. It's shown in the movie how other teachers in that class were essentially saying, well, you know, this is not a top neighborhood, top school, so the kids, you know, take it easy, don't push them too hard, because that will be disappointing. I see that kind of attitude also sometimes around me. I'm sorry to say that I sometimes see that attitude in among some of my colleagues, not all. We have good people, but some of my colleagues always think that this is not a top university, this one, where we are. And that's really sad, because I think what he wrote, what he said, is very, very true. If you expect your children, suppose you have children, you expect them to do very well, and you treat them as future generals and professors and whatever you dream of course, depending on what they choose. But if you think of them as winners, as people who will do very well, they will rise to the occasion. This is the way people usually work. If you think they are losers, they are not going to do too well, they will also become losers. I think it's a very important idea in education, when you have people. It's amazing sometimes what happens with people who are not necessarily in the best environment, best prepared. It's amazing what you can do with people. Another person who is inspiring was a Polish general, Stanisław Sosabowski, who was in the Western Front fighting on the side of the British and Americans. He is pictured in a movie, One Bridge Too Far, about this Operation Market Garden when they were invading Europe. He's pictured by Gene Hackman. I don't know if you know who Gene Hackman is. He was one of the a very good actor just a few decades ago. Maybe he is forgotten now. In any case, his people were not necessarily the most fit, the best. Like you've heard the name Gurkhas, probably. The British have a regiment of Gurkhas. They are selected among the generally very, very good fighters. That nation is just amazing in Nepalese. The history is funny. The British tried to conquer them. And they conquered them, but they had such heavy losses when they were fighting in Nepal that after conquering them, they decided we want those people to be on our side, because otherwise we cannot handle too many battles like this. So that's the tradition. They started, they formed a Gurkha regiment, and every year to this day, they take the best people every year to that regiment, and they are indeed amazing. So Sosabowski got, you could say, whatever material he had. The Polish soldiers who escaped in 1939, the Second World War, they escaped to the West, and they were not always the top people physically, the best candidates for soldiers. He trained them to the point that they were really very, very good army. In that operation, he was actually against that operation. He thought it was not a very good idea. He was probably right. A lot of his soldiers were killed in that operation because he was asked to cross a big white river. A lot of them died in that battle, but overall they did quite well. So he believed he could make the top soldiers, and he actually did. So that's another thing that you could. I found it very inspiring. Always, this is something that I have to admit that I don't fully understand. Maybe you can help me with that. This is a quote from Lao Tzu, a Chinese wise guy, centuries ago. So wicked leader is he who the people despise. People don't like him, they hate him. That's not a very good leader. He said, then, a good leader is he who the people revere. So they love him, you know, once he dies, they may build a monument for him. He was a good leader. But then he says something that I find to this day, there are several interpretations of what he said. The great leader, so not good, great leader, is he who the people say, we did it ourselves. Not him, we did it. So what do you think about that? There's another version of that. A leader is best when people barely know he exists. When his work is done, his aim fulfilled, they will say, We did it ourselves, the same thing. So what do you think? What is your interpretation of these words? Didn't make any sense to me when I first read it. I thought the middle, the good leader, is what the best we can achieve as leaders. So what do you think?
The great leader gives opportunities that people may not... the great leader gives opportunities that people may not even see, but they get it, and the opportunity seems to be obvious to them. Uh-huh. And maybe that's why they don't see that
he
can exist. I don't know, I can see
this. There is something in it, I think. As you know, you may know that most brilliant ideas are obvious once you have them, yes? Like the wheel. The wheel is an obvious idea, but only because we have it. But none of the American civilizations had the wheel, right? So it means that it's not very obvious. They didn't have carts and things like we have here in our... in Western Europe, in Europe, or most of the places in the world actually had wheels. It's an interesting point that he has given them something that afterwards they find obvious. Of course, yes, that's an interesting thing.
I would say it's more about giving someone a hint, not a precise idea, which is already prepared. When you give someone a hint, he can actually work on it and create an idea by himself. Mm-hmm. So at the end, he's going to feel that the idea was his own. So that's the whole thing. Yeah.
So maybe the leader doesn't know himself or herself, but gives them some freedom,
exactly,
and environment where they can come up with a good idea. And then it's... That's also, I think, interesting. There are two interpretations that I found appealing. I mean, what you said is definitely also very true, I think. But the two interpretations is the following. The first is, a leader is, like you said, creating an environment for people to develop, to have ideas, to do things. And if the leader does not everything for them, then there's less work to do, right? The leader can just create a good environment and focus on really important things, high-level ideas, and the people do the actual work, bring ideas, develop things, the more people, the better ideas there may be, yes, in the crowd. So they think that they did it all by themselves, that the leader just created an environment. So less work is fine, one thing. The second thing that I thought in this context about is when less work, dirty work, but you have more time to think, to inspire them. The second idea is that everybody dies. The leader will also die at some point. Or you will leave the university, the leader will stay. In a sense, the leader has died, right? I mean, for you, you left some, you went somewhere else. When the leader dies, there is nobody sometimes to follow up that idea, that line of work or whatever. So the feeling among the students, among the followers, that it's our idea, we did it ourselves, helps the idea, that school, to survive. That's another thing that I thought in this context about. So if they think that they did it by themselves, the leader was not really needed. When the leader disappeared, okay, we will light a candle on the grave, but otherwise, not a big deal. Everything has survived, yes? That's the second idea why this may be a wise approach. In any case, I think the things that you said, I think it makes a lot of sense. Create the environment, let the people have ideas, give them an opportunity to have good ideas and to do things. So in mentoring, I think sometimes you have a feeling that a poor leader, of course, will feel jealous towards the students, But a good teacher or good professor, you know, in whatever environment they teach, I think that good leader wants the students to move further than he or she himself has reached. A good parent will want the children to achieve more things, higher things than they achieved, that they dreamt of. I think it's a, and you can make it clear to the students somehow that, you know, the sky is the limit, they should go further than you did. You want them to get the best out of themselves. Everybody has a lot of strength in them, so help them to see that they have the strength, that they can do it. I think this is the second thing. They have to do it by themselves, so don't lead them by the hand. In fact, the times that I was leading my students by the hand, the doctoral students, I'll tell you that in the later on, about the pitfalls of mentoring, the students who were led most by the hand, they didn't really achieve much. The students who were kind of independent, given their own way, they often got further. They need to learn a lot, and they should understand that they need to learn a lot, and it would be the easiest for them to learn from you, because you are very close to them. And if you are from you and from other people, of course, never be jealous about this. And they also need support. It's like children. Little children need support. Little children need food, milk, breast, and you know, later they need other things. Big children, like you are in a way, you need support also, because you are moving in an area that is not completely understood. You need guidance. So you need to be supported, both materially and mentally. You need to... your mentor has to find ways of increasing your earnings if money is a problem, and then mentally, if you have any kind of problems, there should be support for you. I guess it can be summarized the way I view it now, of course. It wasn't that I was born with that idea and that quote. I think it's important to inspire, to show the possibilities, show how to do it, but let them do it by themselves. So just show them how to do it, but they need to do it themselves. You've seen this slide. Loving what you do, doing what you love, is very important. So, of course, for us as leaders, but also for other people. So make sure that they enjoy what they are doing. You have to be a role model, and that's an interesting thing, because we are all humans with all our flaws, but we have to realize that we are being looked at, we are watched, and imitated. I had this terrible experience once with my first son. He was like that. Of course, I was teaching him to brush his teeth like a parent should. So I would take a toothbrush. He had his small toothbrush. I would put some toothpaste on his toothbrush, on mine, and then open the water to make it moist. He couldn't see what's inside, but he was doing something like that over the sink. He could see that there's water. The next thing I do, that was my kind of habit, is I shake my toothbrush against the sink a couple of times so that the excess water goes away. Many of you may be doing this. And then I noticed that my son, he had no idea, of course, what I was doing, but he was watching me and also doing this. Right? Then I realized, boy, I'd better not pick my nose when he is around, because he will be imitating it too. That terrible experience that I told you about, if you haven't had it, I guarantee you will have it. At the age of 30-something, you know, when you have your own family, your children, you will catch yourself doing things that you've seen in your parents and you didn't like it at all, you hated it, and then you will say, oh, what did I just say? You know, think I just said something that I always hated in my father or my mother. So the reason why I'm telling you those two anecdotes is that people learn best by observing. I once read something very interesting, and I think it's very true. Children don't do what you tell them to do when you bring up children. but they do what they see the parents do. So essentially, if you want to bring up good children, be good yourself. Yes. If you do small dishonest things, you are essentially teaching them to be also dishonest because they are observing you. If you want them not to pick their noses, don't pick your nose. Of course, I'm joking here. I don't think anybody does that. So definitely, they have to learn. They want to steal your knowledge. And of course, you have to be very... You shouldn't mind. This is an environment, university is an environment where people want you to steal their knowledge and they don't mind it. And you should not mind it. Make it worth stealing, make it valuable so that they want to learn from you. And they will learn more from you if they respect you. Think about the times when you were learning from your parents. The times that you disagreed with them, you disrespected them because they did something that you didn't like. Maybe they did something dishonest, maybe they were using some language that you didn't like, you are unlikely to learn from them. So it helps people around you to learn when they respect you. They think you are a good person. What that means in practice is you have to be a good person, because if you are not a good person, they will see it immediately, like children do. When we are teenagers, we are so critical. We can see all the flaws in other people, in our parents especially, we can see it. And I think young people especially, maybe still your age, are also critical. So when you see things that you don't like in your mentor, you will notice that and you will probably lose the respect for your mentor. So the lesson is, never do anything that you don't want students to learn. If you want to produce first-class scholars, you have to be a good scholar yourself. You have to work hard to get the best out of try to get the best out of yourself, then from your people. A best leader doesn't say attack. The best leader says follow me. Right? Attacks goes first. Students are often employees. They are getting stipends. They are working maybe at the university. So they are younger colleagues, but special ones. I mean, they are younger, but your colleagues. You have to respect them, of course, as a leader. And there is more in mentoring than professional contact, definitely, because. They see you, you know, you have a meeting, an hour long, let's say, they talk to you. Sometimes they see you read something or watch something, they will observe you. So you are not just teaching science, there are other things that they are learning from you. And that holds also for being a leader in the industry, anywhere where you are, I think. Just act naturally, be yourself, but be such that other people will follow you. Try to strive to be better, to be ideal. If you don't want them to see unethical things in you, just don't do anything that is unethical. That's a simple recipe. You can talk with them over tea or coffee, you know. You have to drink tea or coffee sometimes. Yes, so when you are there with a student, make a chat. How are you? How are you doing? What's up, etc. Talk with them. Then interactions are more relaxed. What happened a lot in US is especially because there are many foreign students, foreign doctoral students. When there was a holiday, of course, they felt sometimes lonely. There's the biggest American holiday, Thanksgiving. The reason why it's biggest is because that is independent of people's religion, of people's faith. It's a time where people just celebrate being American, I guess. They meet, most people go to visit their parents, to have dinner with their family. What happens to foreign students? They suddenly feel lonely. Once I heard a Thai student saying that for Thanksgiving they went to McDonald's and ordered a turkey sandwich. That's so sad. In that environment, we often organized a dinner, Thanksgiving dinner, where not only my sons were there, but also foreign students. Not the American ones, because they went to see their family, but foreign students. You can do that for Christmas, for 4th of July, which is the Independence Day in US. People do barbecues, you can invite them there. Once in a while, you can invite an individual student for dinner to your house. That's another thing that you can do. And interestingly, there was once a workshop for young faculty. That was the beginning of September. The university organized a workshop, and there were a few lectures for young new faculty and a few panels. And in one of the panels, there was a professor who said something like this. I used to invite students to my house for Thanksgiving, but I stopped doing this. Imagine that the student, on the way to my house, breaks his leg, and he sues me, goes to court, blames me that he broke his leg on the way to my house. I've heard many stupid statements, but this was one of the most repulsive. If you were my student and I invited you to my house, you broke your leg and you sued me, you would be my student for maybe a few more hours, right? I would tell you, that's it, right? How can you, being ethical, being a human, blame somebody who invited you that you broke your leg on the way? I mean, that was really so stupid of the guy. It didn't make me stop inviting my students for home or doing things. There were other things that I definitely kept doing in US environment. That is not yet happening in Poland, luckily. But there was an environment. There are several things that are kind of political. One of the things is, for example, this craze about sexual harassment. So you know, everybody in the supervisory position can take advantage of the people below, right? So a teacher should not go out with a female student. I don't know what happens to homosexual teachers, by the way. What I had to do, kind of, you know, but under the pressure of the politics, is if I had a female student come to my office, then I always kept the door open. But that is, I didn't like it because that kind of brings immediately a feeling of distrust. I distrust her that she might accuse me of sexual harassment, and she doesn't trust me because, I kept the door open. It was even like I had a female student once, a doctoral student, she came into my office and locked the door behind her. The doors didn't have windows, you know, it was my room. So, very difficult situation, because if I go and open the door, I'm showing distrust towards her. So what I did is, you know, after a couple of minutes or so, I just walked around, and then, you know, when I was close to the door, I opened it, so that I cannot be accused of sexual harassment. And later on, it was very good, because we had a wonderful lab that a colleague of mine found, because he used to smoke in different parts of the building when smoking was forbidden. There was a low, like between the zero and first floor, there was a wonderful lab, and one of the rooms was completely covered with glass. And I could easily close the door when I was talking to a student. Everybody could see me, right? So I was not, no longer afraid of that. So, but every environment is full of all kinds of political issues. The same here. There's no environment that is free of that. In any case, be careful with the personal contacts, because sometimes the society around you may not accept it. For example, it would be very nice sometimes to continue a conversation with a student over a glass of beer. You go, it's 5 o'clock, why don't we go to a pub and then have a glass of beer? I've never invited a female student to do that with me. Again, sorry for my female students, but I just wanted to avoid problems. So with guys I would go sometimes. We even once went to a place those dancers, kind of half-naked dancers. We once went to that, kind of for fun, because there was a guy with a visitor from China. That was an interesting story. He came to us, we accepted him. as a postdoc, and he can kind of almost from the airplane, he comes and says, well, and by the way, the Chinese government was lying. They didn't give me any money. So immediately pressure to find money for him. I found some money for him. He was a little disappointed with that. It was not a lot of money. And then at some point, you know, months later, he was not producing. So we thought, kind of for a joke, he needed inspiration. So a group of guys, we actually went, took him out to for some inspiration. That was my adventure with, you know, a very, very informal setting. In any case, there are definitely informal settings also, and you have to use them too. So if, you know, every time you make tea or coffee, we had a kitchen actually, which was very nice, because when I went to the kitchen to put the kettle on, somebody else would come, we would talk, and this kind of interactions are also important. The same with in a workplace. You need to know your people in all kind of circumstances. You teach by example. Not only things that they should do, you know, not only research, but you also discuss with them things. Like, suppose your paper gets rejected. You get a paper from a journal that is rejected, and you know, you read the reviews. Sometimes you can tell, you can share it with your students. You know, I got this terrible review. The reviewer didn't know what he was writing about. Yes, you can just share it with them, so that they know that things like that happen to everybody, including you. It's nothing unusual. Show them that you work hard. So if you have a lab where people are working, it's quite okay for them to see you at 2 o'clock in the morning working. Without saying a word, they see that you are working hard. If you remember the lecture by Randy Pausch, he said something like in the lecture, if you want me to show how I have succeeded, why don't you come to my office at 10 o'clock in the evening on Friday night? He said something like this. That's exactly it, you know. See them, let them see you working hard. Another thing that you can do that gets you kind of closer, helps them, the students, is think aloud when you are meeting with them sometimes. I remember, I learned it when I was interacting with Herb Simon. Remember that I showed him a few times how to find the research topic is one of the things that I told you about. I would meet with him. He was a big guy. He was, great guy, not big in the sense of his size. And I was very kind of shy. I was a doctoral student, fairly young still. What do I know about science and the world? And he was a guy famous in four areas, hundreds of publications, Nobel Prize, National Academy of Science, you know, he was one of the greatest people in that university, which was very good to start with. So believe me that I was listening to him very carefully, and just that air of this kind of person being around me. And then we would sit opposite to each other in chairs, and I would tell him about a problem I was thinking about, I was working on. And then he would do something like this. He would kind of go into his chair deeper, stretch his legs a little, close his eyes, and then he would think, okay, well, if we do this, then. He would think aloud. Why was it so important? Because then I realized, listening to him, I can do that too. There is no magic in his thinking. I can do that too. So I can do what a person, famous person can do, Nobel Prize winner, right? I can do that too. That's why I think it's a good idea to show sometimes how you approach problems, how you think, how you do things. I think it's very valuable. So once you are a boss, do that. Once you are managing people, let them see that you are. There's no magic in your thinking. You are doing exactly whatever they would do in that situation. Healthy environment. That's also important. And there is an inequality built into the system. You are a professor, and your student, you may have doctoral students, master's students in one lab. It's a good idea, by the way, when you have doctoral students and you take a master's student also, master student may support the research of one of the doctoral students or you, have them come to the same meetings, have them there around. So you need to create a healthy environment. If they need a desk, find the desk for them. If they need a computer, if their stipend is not high enough, if they need money because something happens. Your stipends, I know they are not very high. They are much higher than they used to be when my wife, for example, did her doctorate in this university. So I think you can probably live off them, although it's poor living. And it's not abnormal. When I was a student in US, similarly, I had barely enough. I was married, I had already one child when I was entering the PhD studies. We ate up some of our savings, but okay, we were investing in the future. So poor living. So I'm not talking about helping the student to buy a car and buy a new leather jacket and a new model of iPhone. No, not that. But if let's say a student is in problems, let's say has to support the parents, or the student has a child or something. Try to see if there is any way, in Poland you can do it too, if there is any way you can help them to earn some money. Maybe there is some project, maybe they can do some part-time work outside of the university, maybe you can help them finding. So these are examples of practical things that you can do. Show interest in their development. If they do something good, recognize it, praise them. Only for things that are good. Don't say all the time, good job, because that's ridiculous. There was a period, I hope it's over now, I don't know, when they were teaching parents to tell the children always, good job, wonderful. They come with something, you know, not worth praising, say, wow, good job, very nice. You bring up, essentially, when you do this, you bring up snowflakes. You know the term snowflake. These are the people who are getting insulted by anything, yes? You know, then something happens, somebody tells them something critical, suddenly they kind of get, you know, tragedy happened. There was a cartoon that I remember from 1970s, one of those Polish cartoonists, maybe Mleczko, maybe somebody else, there was a one-page cartoon in a magazine. July 1960, I was born. And then, you know, whatever, 10 years later, I got my first failing grade at school. Then, 10 years later, my boss has, a bird has pooped on me. The next one, my boss told me something critical. And then, 10 years later, I was drowning. As always in this kind of situations, I recalled all the important things from my life. It was very funny, anyway. Praise people, but when they deserve it. When they don't deserve it, you don't have to be critical. You give them advice how to do things, but you don't have to shout at them or be very critical, but just say critical things. I remember when I was working on my master's thesis in the Netherlands, I was writing it, and my professor, I liked him a lot. He died, unfortunately, just a few years ago. Luckily, I visited him before he died. He said, Marek, I thought you can write better. Wow, that was devastating for me. You know? I thought I could write well, too. And he tells me, Marek, I thought you could write better. I had higher hopes of you. That wasn't a very nice thing to do, but it was very motivating, of course, for me. I'm the person who gets motivated by critique like this, but it was quite, I would say, I wasn't close to crying, of course, but it was devastating. So you don't have to be like that, although you can say critical things, but typically when you criticize people separately. So if you have individual meeting, I can say something critical, never in the among other people. When you praise, on the other hand, I say, did you hear what he did recently? His paper got into blah, 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 right? That's nice. People and children and students also they get much more motivation from praises. But those praises have to be, of course, justified. You praise good things. Somebody said critically something funny about marriage. Marriage is a place where you ignore bad behavior and praise good behavior. There is something in it, you know. Not completely. I think you can say something critical now and then. Not too critical, but you praise good behavior, and that way you can form the other person. The same with your people who are working for you. Praise good things. It's more powerful than critique, although when it's deserved, you also criticize. So interest in the development, recognize progress, praise them. Facilitate exchange of ideas among the students. Sometimes, in some places, people are afraid of sharing things, like, you know, like that, I'm not telling you, and so. And that's a terrible environment. Why would they want to do it? Well, maybe they are afraid that somebody will steal ideas from them. But in your group, you should create definitely an atmosphere where people should not get into each other's path. So if I know what you are working on, and I'm another student, then I try to avoid your area. If I don't avoid it because I talk to you and I have a good idea, what happens? Why don't we work on it together and publish a paper together, right? That's what you do. Stealing an idea that never happened in my group, but if that happened, I would definitely have a very serious conversation with the two students involved. So I don't think that in a good environment there should be any worry about stealing ideas. If you want to keep things secret, do it towards people you don't know. But inside the group, it should be a good environment, like a family. So exchange ideas, speak freely, encourage cooperation rather than competition. There are environments where they, let's say, hire two people and they say, we want to hire permanently one of you. So I hire the two of you and tell, okay, next year this time, only one of you will be here. If I were to work in an environment like this, I would be the one who leaves, probably. I work terrible in an environment like this. I don't know how you would feel. Some people are maybe motivated, but that's a terrible environment. A much better environment is when you compete, but through cooperation. You compete in the following way. I say something good about him in a group meeting. He published something, a good paper. What do you think? What do the others think? I want that too. That's a good competition, right? I want to be that successful too. And you want to create something like this, not kind of an environment where one of us will survive or two of us will survive, the others, you know, like that. If somebody creates an environment like this, he or she is losing a lot, I think, in both industry and university. Of course, if somebody is not performing well, you give feedback, you tell them, you can say goodbye to somebody, but not just because you want them to fight with each other who is the best. You want them to be inspired by each other. Imagination, creative pursuits, so that they are not afraid of joking, fantasizing, like, remember, we talked about this. Students sometimes are curious. Talk to them often. They may be interested in how you do things. They may come to you with problems, saying, okay, I have to fill out my taxes. Where can I best do that? You give them advice. They may ask you, do you know a good car mechanic? Sure, I can tell them where I go with my cars. And so. And then encourage them to learn as much as they can and in the direction where they are going. So advise them with courses. There are some courses you can select here in this program, not in the first couple of years, I think, but then later. So let the advisor tell which courses you should take. One thing that I think I don't like in this program is that there are special doctoral courses. I think that you should be open, free to take any course in this university and University of Białystok, courses that teach you something that you want to know. I think that should be possible. Not just a set of courses. What happens now is I have one student in a course. I'm meeting him tomorrow. So I'm giving normal lectures like here, but there's one person in the audience. I think that's a waste of resources. Terrible waste. I feel guilty because they are paying me as if there were 50 students there. There's only one. That's so funny. Identify the skills that they have to learn. I mean, in my case, this was really part of the mission statement. I actually made it explicit. Here is what you need to learn. So if you want them to write papers, learn to write, have them write and submit papers. Encourage them to do that. Have them present. You can do it in group meetings, in your lab meetings. Every week somebody is presenting. Give them papers to review. You are already ready sometimes to, maybe not yet, because maybe you are not deep enough in your area, but in 1, maybe 2 years, you will know enough to be a reviewer of a paper. Your advisor can give you a paper in your area and say, "When would you like to review it?" Of course, there's a lot of work, you have to read, to understand, etc. But with your advisor's help, you can learn how to review. Teaching, I know that you will have to teach a little bit in this program, but that, there was no requirement like this at the University of Pittsburgh and in U.S. universities generally not. Then you can ask, well, I'm going on a trip, a conference. Would you like to teach a class for me? Right? And the student should, it's of course a lot of work. You have no experience with teaching. You have to prepare for a 1.5 hours class. That's a lot of work. It will take you a few days, maybe a week. But you will have an opportunity to learn to teach. It's also important when you write letters of recommendation. I can write, "He taught my classes and the students liked it a lot." Of course, if they like it, if they don't like it, they start complaining that, the lecture was bad. You don't write it. Then I write, "He taught my classes." Send them to conferences because they will understand how the science works, how to present. They will interact with other people and network. So that was motivating for me. In my first year of doctoral studies, after the first year, there was a conference and my advisor asked me, "Would you like to go?" Of course, I would like to go. And another student was driving there, so we drove together. There were minimal costs to drive. The conference fee was reduced for students also. I stayed in a dormitory, very inexpensive accommodation. So, and I paid for my own food, so that was a good deal. And that was very motivating, because in that conference, I realized I want to be like those people presenting. A year later, I had already a paper in that conference. 1 or 2 papers, I forgot now. But that was very motivating. So if you can, send people to conferences. And make sure that they have up-to-date CV, because they never know. Suddenly there may be an opportunity, they need a CV. So help them to keep it up. Give them some critic. I learned how to write a CV when I was in the Netherlands writing with my advisor, the same that I mentioned, Van der Hoor, who criticized me, because I was looking for a job, and he helped me with that. And the advice he gave me, I'm still using that. Ethics, don't tolerate dishonesty. Sometimes, that's an interesting point in Poland, especially. We are very unique in this society, because, I'm not saying that doctoral students, I hope not, but I noticed in students at the lower level, the engineering students, or even masters sometimes, and there is dishonesty. They try to cheat the professor. They are cheating it by using the LLMs where it's not allowed. They are copying sometimes. In the exam, they are using some other materials. That's just dishonesty, plain dishonesty. No tolerance for that. You should not tolerate it among your people. So that's just simple. Don't use those special words like ściąga, daje, odpisać. These are all words that are trying to justify something that is ethically absolutely wrong. But it's deep in our society that it happens. One of the reasons is the penalties are not very high. for something like this in a American university, very often you have to say goodbye. They will kick you out, essentially. If it's, of course, a brutal way of cheating, plagiarism or something. In Poland, it's interesting. Maybe the penalties are not very high because people are used to it. They did it themselves, so they don't want to harm the students later. But I read an article about this, and they wrote in the article that even during the Second World War, where Germans were forbidding any education above the elementary education, they wanted to create a society of workers, essentially. So they were secret schools. People were meeting at different apartments, teaching and learning. In that article, they wrote that even in that environment where they were risking their lives, because if Germans learned, they would arrest them all and send them to Auschwitz. They would quite likely die there. So even in that environment, there were cases of cheating. Amazing, isn't it? Don't accept poor quality work. Here you can afford it. You may not afford the time to check the work of the students when you are teaching a class, but when you have just a handful of future scientists, you can afford to read carefully, to give them good feedback. Quality. It is helpful to write a mission statement. I was very skeptical, and that's also historical. Because I grew up in a communist time, a communist country. I mean, communist was imposed on Poland. We were not communist, but it was imposed. I became very critical of all kinds of ideologies. I noticed the same among Chinese students from China, from communist China. Very critical of ideologies. So when I first heard that about a mission statement, I thought, nah, that's one more of those bullshit things, not for me. But then I went to a workshop where somebody described the following anecdote. You know the company FedEx, of course. So FedEx had an idea. They started the company. The idea was to collect letters from different places in the city or different cities, bring them to a central location. I think it was St. Louis, which is kind of pretty much in the middle of the United States, sort them, and then bring them back by plane to the destination. Not back, but to the destination. And then they could get something in one night, overnight, essentially. That was an idea. Before that, of course, things took longer. So now, good idea, but they did not. Things were not working out. And then they got together, the management, and they decided to write a mission statement. The mission statement was very short. Overnight, over there. That was before the current mission statement, which is the world on time. You might have seen that one. I hope it's still there, last time I looked. But before that, there was overnight over there. So they made sure that everybody in the company understood it and applied it. Overnight over there. And there was, this is the anecdote. So far it was all facts. The anecdote is the following. There was a driver of a truck, a FedEx truck, who was going around the city to pick up the letters. There are boxes in the street sometimes, and the boxes are screwed to the concrete so that nobody can move them. And if you want to send something, you just open the box and throw in the letter with your credit card data, or maybe you have an account with them. So there was a guy, a driver, who came, and then he had a key normally to open the box, take the letters on the truck and to the next thing. And somehow there was a reporter who was filming him. Beautiful story, I don't know if it's true. In fact, I don't know if it's true. So the guy couldn't open the box. He got a key, couldn't open, he got another key, then he got a monkey wrench. Monkey wrench is a Klucz-Franciszki in Polish. He couldn't open it, no way. At some point he tried all kinds of things. Looking at the watch, he had to go to the airport because the flight out of the city to St. Louis was going at some time, point in time. At some point, he got another monkey wrench and unscrewed the whole box from the concrete. So got it off. Gets the box to the car, doesn't fit, that the door is too narrow. He cannot get the box inside. Terrible. He finds out that he uses a duct tape. Remember, the duct tape is that American invention, very strong tape with glue. He glues that box to the truck and goes quickly to the airport. And then a reporter learns about this and goes to the guy and says, well, why did you do all this? And the guy says, well, man, this is my job. My job was to get those letters from here to the airport so that it can go overnight over there. And the reporter asks, were you not afraid that your boss would be angry for you unscrewing the box? And he says, no, man, my boss's job is to get those letters from here to there, and how could he be mad about this? I was just doing my job. She told it in a juicy, funny way. I realized then that if you have a group of people, if you have your team, and you make everybody understand what they are there to do, then it helps a lot sometimes. Because if there's an argument, why would I do that? The answer is simple. To get the letters from here to there. Simple. Some people even advise to write a mission statement for a marriage. You know, the two young people say, what do we want from this marriage, from this family? What do we want? If anything happens in the future, something, you can always ask, how did that, what happened, support our mission? How did it make, how did it help, right? Or how can we, in times of trouble, how can we react? There's another inspiring thing, a book called, what's the name of the book? It's about the secret of companies that last for a long, long time. Maybe I'll tell you that next week when we talk about stress and time. I think I have a slide even on that. So later. In any case, mission statement. Our mission statement was very long. In this case, I can write really long. So it was like 3-4 pages. This was just brief statement and then elaboration, which actually had those 18 things that you have to learn and other things. The mission statement even had names of the journals where we want to publish, the most reputable journals where we want to publish. And every year we met on a retreat, we were actually reading that there was a quiet time of 15 minutes or 20 minutes. We were individually reading the mission statement and then discussing, is there anything we should change there? Anything that we could make better? This is my lab. You see, this is my office, the windows. That was very lucky because everybody could see what I was doing. You could always accuse anybody of anything, but accusing me of sexual harassment there would be funny. There was an anecdote. I remember a colleague of mine, a philosopher, Clark Glimmer, once he said, I bought a hammock for my office. Because sometimes you feel kind of tired, you want to have a nap. I said, hammock? He said, yeah, I wanted to buy something that you can sleep in and that you cannot have sexual intercourse in. For the same reason. I told him, what do you mean you cannot have a sexual intercourse in a hammock? I was, of course, pulling his leg. And he said, well, maybe you can, but I cannot. He was a really big guy. It was exactly the same reason. He didn't want to be ever accused of having a bed or a mattress or something in his office. But that's a big thing in the US. I think it's still there, probably. Lab is very important. What we used to have in my department is the students were housed in different offices. So one of my students was on the 5th floor, another one was on the 7th floor. And it was difficult. So when my good colleague told me about this space, space was a mess. There was there was rubbish and things. He used to come and smoke here. So he knew about it. We asked for this space, and the dean, I'll tell about it in a moment, later. So they renovated the space, painted it for us. I had money from grants to buy desks. Suddenly we have wonderful space. And it made such a big difference. Everybody was together physically. So we knew we could talk. We had a small kitchen even in that space. That wall over there, there's a kitchen behind it. And big whiteboards where we could write. I ordered the whiteboard. It was like 2 meters by 3 by 4 meters. Really big whiteboard. And I bought, there was even a couch. We could sit comfortably during the meetings. This is me from inside my office looking at the window, outside of the window. I think it's important. And many people don't realize how important it is to bring people together. The reason why Carnegie Mellon is so successful is because it's so small. Psychology department is next to philosophy. No, sorry, psychology is on the second floor, philosophy is on the bottom. Philosophy is next to statistics. So easy to interact, so nice. Being together is really important, physically together. Teaching, this is another advice. If you are a young faculty, you should teach a course in your area. Why? Because that is a way of inspiring students to work with you later. Like students who say, oh, can I work on a master's thesis with you? Or can I do a PhD with you? They will not do it if they don't know your area. So even if there is no course in your area, you should propose one for free. Just propose a course. I'm afraid it's not that easy here, I think. It's not that flexible. But, you know, teach a seminar for those people who want to learn more. You may find people to teach. So it's a good idea to teach a course. When you are a young faculty, ask for courses. Ask if you can teach a course. Have influence maybe on the program of studies. Team building, again, everywhere, but here it's also very important. The idea is that a team works better than a group of disconnected individuals. Usually it's not n times the power, it's more than n. You get more from the team. Not competition, but collaboration. And kind of, if you want competition, then the healthy one. Saying, I want that too, I want to be successful too. Share responsibilities, but also privileges. When you have something, share it. Remember, Randy Pausch took every student from his lab to Disneyland, right? Was it Disneyland? He took them all. How could you do it, somebody asked. How could I not do it? That was the question. Criticism is important. You should absolutely teach it also in your family. Giving criticism, constructive criticism, not like... you don't make any sense, or you are stupid. That's a ridiculous criticism, right? But when you criticize, say it in a way that shows a better way. Yes, and then people accepting criticism, not the first reaction, who is criticizing me? You cannot do it better either, right? That's a very often reaction that you see in the society. No, not this. Somebody criticizes you, teach people to be thankful for that. Because people criticizing open up themselves. They can make an enemy if the criticism is not accepted. So definitely it's a very important skill. A feeling of performance, not a project. Often people get money for a project, hire students, there is a team, the project ends. Well, thank you very much, that's over. We had a lab, not a project. So students were there for the duration of their doctoral studies the whole time. Together you can make better decisions, and people will also learn to make better decisions. We did definitely that. Did I show this picture? No? What's the common theme here? Well, you see, this is a dead marine. It's a funeral, probably. And this is three women are retiring. And they are getting flowers, diplomas, maybe gift cards, etc. This guy, of course, nothing will help him at the moment. Yes, he's going to go to the ground. Both of these events are not for the people who are, not for the ladies who are retiring and not for the guy here. This is for the people who are staying. For the soldiers to realize that if I die, people will be playing the national anthem, give a flag to my family, and there will be a big event. For the people who are staying, those people, they feel, when I retire, they will be also very nice to me too. I noticed that definitely here, in Białystok, but sometimes also in US, that people come and disappear without any announcement. When you get new people in your lab, send email to your people saying, we will have coffee to welcome John on Friday. Yes? And then you introduce John, he is a new member of the lab, ask him to tell something about himself, and then have coffee, buy cakes. Where do you get the money from? If there is no source, take it from your pocket. I mean, as a boss, you should be able to afford to pay $20 for coffee, yes? What I notice here also, in our department, we have sometimes new people, and I notice, well, I've never seen this person, sometimes people disappear without a farewell event. Another thing that I noticed, which is very, very strange, is that people who are leaving often invite others to come, and they are paying for the cake. They are bringing and paying for the cake. That's ridiculous. I think the employer should have enough money to pay for that. If not, if I were the dean, I would just pay for it myself. I will not feel it in the long run, this small amount, but I will feel if my group is not working, if my department is not working well. They've been fired, but they were very nice about it. Keep your relationships. I think relationship student is forever. I have definitely always visited my advisor whenever I was in town, talk, and I have a programmer, for example, who left in 1999. 5 years later, I asked him, can you please look at your program, because we had a problem, something is not working. He looked. Amazing, isn't it? There are definitely tangible benefits of keeping relationships. An example, you've heard about Grünbaum, Adolf Grünbaum, in the context of creativity. Incredibly creative person, incredibly good teacher. One of the best, very best teachers I've ever had. Teachers, you know, for adults like us, teaching science and research. That's his former student. His former student at another university when he was still very young took a class from him, and then he took every single class that he was teaching, Grünbaum. And then, 30 years later, he sends him an email. Dr. Grünbaum, I have to say I've been very successful in life, materially, financially, and I credit that to your teaching. Can I do something nice for you? Can I buy you a house? And Grünbaum, of course, says, Grünbaum, I already have a house. So maybe I can do something nice, something for your department. Finally, he accepted, I think, $1 million. He could have given more, but they wanted to see how the university will deal with that million. You know, this is a true story. This is an article about him and his wife donating the million. I think it was million, maybe more, I forgot. Another example, as a young student, she got a stipend from the university, from the department. Then she comes back, 10, 20 years later, establishing a fund for the best students, for stipends. Things like that happen, and if you want to be a teacher, be a good teacher. Be a teacher to whom students are coming back. Letters of recommendation is an honorable duty. You have to do it definitely. Write strong letters. That's a game. You write strong letters. I told you him, he had to go. He told me he has to go earlier. Suppose the students did not like his teaching. I still write, he taught my classes. I was very thankful to him. Something very, very good, yes? All good things. And give the opportunity to write the students, give the students the opportunity for a good letter by asking him different things so that you can write. He taught my classes, he helped me with reviewing and whatever. Some people cannot just make up their mind and cannot make a decision. And that's a deadly thing of a leader. as a leader, you have to make a decision sometimes. So this is a funny joke. You can look at it. Let's call a committee. Exactly, this is what the dean did at that time. We found that space. Roger, my colleague, was smoking there. I said, we want that space. And the dean says, oh, what a nice space. Why don't we form a committee to assign it to somebody? I was quite mad. Roger was mad too. Yes, we found it. It was our idea. Finally, she gave us, but under a little bit of pressure. So a leader has to make a decision. What we did, I don't have a lot of time left, but if there are some slides left, we'll finish them next week. What we did is once a year we went away for a weekend. That was kind of, you know, announced, without families, just us. And that's one of the weekends we went to. It's a retreat. Retreat, the same word is used for religious retreats, recollectia. But this was just a retreat. You can have retreats with a family, with a company. So we had essentially, we were updating our mission statement, we were cooking together, watching a movie, inspiring movie together, talking, team building, you know, trying to improve our lab. And then you learn each other, you learn me also with when playing frisbee or riding a horse or whatever. That's a nice thing, integrating the group. This is also another retreat. We came up the hill by horse, I think, by horses. There are many places like this in US. There are also places like this here in Podlasia. That wasn't a retreat, but we used to organize canoeing weekends in the summer, just, you know, 2-3 days canoeing with our tents. That was really wonderful, very nice, integrating my people. These are my people, the two, and the others I cannot see now, but pictures of that were hanging in the lab to remind people of that. So I created a lab. I told you that very often I first do and then ask if I invented a new tense in English. That's the the past future tense, whatever, I forgot what I called it. In Polish I would say czas zaprzeszły dokonany. We don't have a tense like this. Essentially, a statement in that tense would be, may I have done something already? Yes. In Polish I would say, czy ja mogłem to już zrobiłem? That's the new tense. Essentially you do things and then you, if it's ethical, if it's not illegal, you do it. I created a lab. Suddenly I formed a web page. I said, wait, we are creating a lab. A few weeks later, my dean passes me in the hallway and says, I saw that you created a lab. Yeah. That was it, right? And then, so we gave it a name. We had a space later. We had annual retreats, traditionally in September, in the beginning of the school year. Social events, we went bowling, we went shooting. In US you can go shooting, like go to a shooting range, hire a gun, like an AK-47, buy ammunition and then shoot. We did that also. Things like that. Canoeing weekends. Once a week we had research meetings, and then we had also business meetings. So that was like from noon to 1 o'clock, business meeting, we were discussing business things. Things that have to be done, organizational things. And research meetings were when somebody was presenting. There's always somebody presenting part of the research, asking questions, sometimes asking help of the others. Day-to-day tasks like buying lunch. Somebody has to buy lunch. Somebody has to clean the kitchen. Once every few months, somebody has to clean the refrigerator. We were taking turns. And I was not avoiding that. I was also inside that group that was doing this. When it was my turn, I was doing this. Decisions were done together. So the meeting chair was rotating, the business meeting. So everybody had his or her turn. Nice thing, because when I write a letter, I can say we had weekly meetings and with a rotating chair, and John was a chair. He did it very well. I can write something nice about that person. That chair had the right to call for voting. The only thing is that in the mission statement I wrote explicitly that I have the right to veto, to say no. The reason for that is that I was responsible for the students financially. They could not outvote me out of my salary or the things. They couldn't. That would be going too far. But I used the veto only once. When there was a student who was too arrogant, I told him to stop working outside because I had money for him in the university. He told me, you are my advisor, you can advise me, but I'm the decision maker. So I decided very quickly, sorry, then I'm no longer your advisor. And then, but I invited him to come to the meetings to question me why I made that decision. He came, which was his mistake, because the others were quite angry at him. Nothing was written in stone. The mission statement was the most important document guiding, but we also, every year, we would look at it again if it needed any change. Sharing the work has to be real. You know this, it's in many languages. There are many, as they say in English, there are many chiefs and not enough Indians, they say. So everybody's kind of a manager here. I think I should stop here. Yes, it's 5:30, so the last slide. I brought myself to the level of doctoral students. So, you know, we would use the going by the first name, of course. And that's an that can be risky. I don't know about our culture in Poland, if it's too risky to come to the level of students, just be an older colleague for the students. I would do the same here. And you can do it. Real products, so we developed software in my lab. That was also a good decision, I think. There was a document for working hours, for appointments. Working hours, essentially, you can work wherever you want, whenever you want. Appointments, something about keeping them, I think, because I want being not more late than 2 minutes or 5 minutes or whatever. There was something about it. Good. There are a few slides left, not too many, that I will finish next week. There are more than I thought. I thought this would take shorter. Thank you very much.